Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. My guests today are Professor Harold Prince, emeritus at Kansas State University, Professor Dan Ranko, a member of the Penobscot Nation, professor of anthropology, and chair of Native American Studies at the University of Maine. My special guests are Evan Rickert, a longtime Maine land use planner and former director of the State Planning Office under Governor Angus King, with decades of experience in regional planning and public policy. My other guest is Roger Milliken Jr., a forest manager and former president of the Baskahegan Company, with a long career in land stewardship and conservation across Maine. Roger and Evan have spent much of their lives working on land and policy issues here in Maine. They're not speaking as advocates for the tribes, but after studying the Maine Indian Claims Settlement Act, they've come to a conclusion that aligns with what Wabanaki Nations have been saying for years. Welcome to the show, Roger and Evan. So I'm going to start with you, Roger, and if you can, I know you guys have done lots of research, and I'd like to know what piqued your interest in doing this research, just in general, tell me about it.
Okay. First of all, it's an honor to be with you and Darren and Harold. Thank you for inviting us on. What prompted us to look into this, into the history of the land claims, was when Representative Golden introduced his bill into the House. We wrote to Senator King in, I think separately, asking him to support the bill. And I reached out with what, in retrospect, you know, was a moral argument. Senator King grew up in Virginia. I grew up in South Carolina. And I spoke to the legacy of the civil rights era and reflected the fact that no progress really would have happened without the intervention of the federal government. At that time of Golden's bill, there was discussion about, was it the state's responsibility to change it, or was it the federal government's responsibility to change it? And I was making the case that there needed to be action at the federal level to change the current unjust situation that denied full sovereignty to the tribes in Maine. And it was clear that the senator was not moved by my line of argument. And Evan, who had worked closely with Angus as a member of his cabinet, said really the best way to approach the senator was with, I'll let you describe what you said, Evan, but that a moral argument, or at least a moral argument alone, was not going to make the difference, that we needed to look deeply into the origins. And it was clear the senator was relying on articles and probably conversations from Robert Patterson, who'd represented the state, you know, one side during the negotiations. And so Evan and I decided together to find out as much as we could about the history that led to the creation of the Settlement Acts. And that's what started us down this path.
Evan?
Yes, thank you. And again, thank you for giving us a chance to be with you and Harold and Darren, who we listened to for a number of hours over the years on your program and learned a lot. I lived in Maine. I was here in Maine and was here when the tribes and the state and the federal government came to a settlement, which seemed like a great victory in 1980. And didn't really think a lot more about it after that. I live in Portland and starting a business and young family and all of that stuff. But in 1995, I became part of Angus's team. I was director of the state planning office, and in that role, I got appointed to the Maine Indian Tribal State Commission. Kind of thrown into it as a real raw rookie, I guess, with no tutorial, no understanding of federal Indian law, just cold. And by 1995, there was a lot of anger on the part of the tribes. And I struggled to understand why during that time. And it was hard to find a really clear understanding. But I did, having read the Settlement Act and having read the Maine Implementing Act, which defined the jurisdictional boundaries of the state and the tribes, I saw a really glaring omission that seemed to be at the root of at least some of the anger, and that there was no definition of internal matters in the law. And just for your listeners, in case they don't know, what the Implementing Act says is that the tribes will have all the powers and duties of a municipality, but the state shall not interfere with the internal matters of the tribes. Internal matters is nowhere defined. A few examples are given, but is nowhere defined. In federal law, we subsequently learned, internal matters has a very broad meaning. You know, the attending to the government, attending to the health, safety, and welfare of its residents, of its citizens. But the state chose to interpret it very narrowly. In any case, I still was sort of at sea about all of this, because I believed in much of the way that I think Governor King at that time believed, and maybe still believed as senator, was that the two parties came to an agreement that they both understood. They came to an agreement that was hard fought, and each party understood what that agreement said, and that they were bound to live by it. And if I come to an agreement with Roger, I expect him to live up to that agreement, and he expects me to live up to that agreement. And I think that's what a lot of people think happened, that the tribes were just mad that it didn't work out the way they had hoped it would. Well, my eyes were really opened. It was probably 2001, 2002, near the end of the time I was in Augusta, when the Great Northern v. Penobscot case on freedom of access came to the courts. And the court said, if the governing body of the Penobscot Nation is communicating with an outside agency, those communications cannot be private. And I thought to myself, well, how the heck? What is internal matter if the minutes of your meetings of the governing body are not internal? And so I think I started to understand late in the game that there was not a common understanding between the two parties, that one party had one very very narrow understanding of parts of the agreement, and another party had an understanding in accord with federal Indian law. Well, in 2021, when Jared Golden's proposed went to Congress, but didn't go anywhere, and then the Sovereignty Acts bills were proposed in the state legislature as a result of the work of the special state commission, Roger and I both submitted testimony in favor of the sovereignty bills, but we decided we really need to understand this, to make an argument that was as watertight as we could, based on our objective understanding of the history of this whole thing, so that folks like Senator King or Jerry Reed in the Attorney General's office or in the governor's office and so forth would come to, could see that this was not a matter of a deal's a deal. This was a matter of two really vastly different interpretations of what the agreement said. And so we dove in and read everything we could and came to really understand that there were two points of view coming out of two understandings, two very divergent understandings that came out of this settlement agreement. The state believing that they had turned the tribes into what they called functional municipalities, and that they had finally warded off the fears that they had at coming out of the legal cases from 1975 to 1979 that officially recognized the tribes as federally recognized tribes with all the inherent sovereignty of federally recognized tribes. Governor Longley at that time had come up with this very clever and powerful piece of demagoguery of no nation within a nation and stirred a lot of fear around that. And they were determined to do something about that. And they came up with this idea that they would be functional municipalities. The tribes did give up things in the settlement as was their right to do so, but they retained a lot, including full control over internal matters. And undefined internal matters really means what is meant in federal Indian law. So that's what the tribes believed that was were being trampled on through the state courts and so forth. And Harold, we picked up a quote from you from one of the episodes, and I'm just going to read it because it's really important to understand how, why even the state courts, which are supposed to be objective bodies looking into, you know, the deep histories and understandings of things, how even they didn't do so 3 years later in the first case dealing with High Stakes Beano. Here's one of the quotes you said, Harold. The conversation about who has sovereign rights is so old that people have forgotten its deep roots. All these lawyers and these legislators and these journalists who are writing and commenting on these issues, they are really not aware of the cultural bedrock in which they operate, the hegemonic system that makes them think in a certain kind of way, that makes them vote in a certain kind of way, and precludes almost any other alternatives. The fight of indigenous peoples of the hegemonic mindset is embedded in the thinking of the legislators and the public in general, and I would say also the justices that heard the first cases coming out, coming to the state Supreme Court, all of whom were appointed by either Governor Longley or Governor Brennan, both of whom were very much steeped in this idea of no nation within a nation. In any case, Roger and I spent off and on 3 years going through all these materials, treatises, interpretations by both negotiators on both sides, the law cases, the federal cases, Stephen Pevar's treatise on federal Indian law, etc. And we came to believe that it was the tribe's interpretation of the Settlement Act that is the correct interpretation, the correct understanding, and so here we are. We hopefully will be a voice that will make, you know, a drip of difference of some kind somewhere along the way.
Okay, Darren.
Thanks, Evan and Roger, for being here. I strongly urge folks to track down the report that they prepared, which I believe this is the title, Maine versus Tribes, Our Attempt to Trace the Roots of Conflict Since the Maine Indian Claims Settlement Act in 1980. Maybe there's a more artful title of it, but it's out there in the public domain. And really what I really like about what you did, and you set up both Roger and Evan, you set up the kind of framing. I think there is at its backbone, this urge or interest in a moral argument. I mean, it's not the core of what this document is, but I think that's what drives what you're trying to do. But I think what I like about this document, in some ways, what's this is people who are knowledgeable about the cases, like many people know the sort of evidence base that you're drawing from, but I think what this does in a really interesting way is lay out those two sides of understanding, of like how is it plausible, first of all, like that there are these different frameworks of interpretation, and a lot of it is what I have said to people over the years, in terms of this idea that the Settlement Act, somehow is the way it's being interpreted and what was actually sort of in a legal framework in 1980 as it was moving through, that these cases after the Passamaquoddy v. Morton case, which recognized us basically as tribes, as being part of the federal trust responsibility. That's what Morton was about. That those cases, in particular, State v. Dana and the Passamaquoddy v. Bottomley case, that those cases were recognizing inherent tribal sovereignty, right? So there was this evolving narrative of like, we are actually being recognized up until the Settlement Act as, for at least 5 years, maybe, or whatever, like in federal and in state court, right? That inherent tribal sovereignty is being recognized. And I think that laying that out, both in terms of those decisions and then the underlying principles of federal Indian law upon which they're based, really helps people who have been like, the tribes were paupers basically for, since 1820, and they were second class citizens, and now they're municipalities. That's the progress, but they have to forget the 75 to 80 period to understand like what it is that we all feel like we've lost in relatively significant ways, related to the Settlement Act and its interpretation. So I would say like that is laid out in a really compelling way. It's very evidence-based. And it also plays out, the position that the state has taken and sort of what drives that interpretation. And so I'd say like, and it extends, I think, Marc Chevrier and like, has an article from the late 80s, making similar arguments. I think laying out the tribal position on this, which is basically like, let's concentrate on these 5 years and these decisions and the frameworks of federal Indian law. And you have to then read the Settlement Act and the legislative history in the Settlement Act, which is mostly from the Senate committee, where people are saying this is not a removal of authorities for by the tribes. This is an enhancement, if anything, and that and other interpretations that the municipality language was not intended as a limitation but an enhancement, like these interpretive measures. And then for whatever reason, the even the federal courts interpreting this at some point later say, no, none of that matters. It's plain language. It's a deal. It's that kind of orientation. Although they, in various sorts of decisions since then, it's been, it's a self-generating body of law, right? So it kind of has it's unstable in terms of interpreting things like internal tribal matters. So I'm glad you picked that up. I've been, I also have criticized this mostly in my dissertation. I don't really consider myself so much a legal scholar, even though I have, a master's in environmental law. I've been really trying to just, point out that this internal tribal matter standard, could be interpreted consistent with federal Indian law. And I had, I've asked some of my students to to look at the 1981 Montana case, which sets out the frameworks for civil re regulatory control by Indian tribes. It's later kind of there's the Hicks case in 2001 further clarifies this case in terms of like where do tribes have civil regulatory authority over non-Indians on fee lands, and it's extended to tribal lands and so forth in the Hicks case. But I think this idea that you could actually tap into something in federal Indian law to interpret this, in that regard too, it wouldn't be it's not a Montana is considered a bad case for Indians in general because it doesn't presume civil regulatory authority over non-Indians in the contours of reservations. So it is a limiting standard, much like you could read municipality or internal tribal matter as sort of limiting or in that way. But it would give some real weight to what, when, where, and how we as sovereign entities could control our own destinies. And the two Montana exceptions. Now, again, the idea that drives Montana is that tribes do not have regulatory authority over non-Indians in their lands, but it does say that when an entity has a consensual relationship, meaning a contract of some sort, then they do. So if they've entered, the non-Indian party has entered into a contract with a tribe, a tribal entity, or the activities of the non-Indians threaten or have some direct effect on the political integrity, economic security, or health or welfare of the tribe. And this is the standard that, for example, reviewing courts have said that, for example, that tribal environmental regulations apply all across the reservation and also regulate non-Indian activities on reservation and fee lands within the context of reservations. So this is cuts to the core, I think, of a lot of what our tribes have been struggling with. To me, I'm big in the environmental field and care a lot about that. My dissertation was about the impacts of pollution on subsistence lifestyles and all of the rest. But I think for me, that drawing that out and showing that to be an inadequate definition and shows you, I think, at its fundamental core, the logic that, the state is operating within, which is not the logic that I would ever presume to operate in, is that tribal sovereignty somehow recognized is a cut against state sovereignty. Like that is a zero-sum game of sovereignties and competition for one another. I think the Harvard study, the Joe Kalt study from a few years ago, clearly articulates why that is completely wrong. It's the tribes, the places where tribes have very, recognized and developed sovereignty, those states greatly benefit from the economic well-being of those tribes in the surrounding areas. And I can only think that, especially where our tribes are located, in some of the most rural, impoverished parts of our state, that the economic well-being of all Maine would be, be benefiting from our forms of sovereignty. So I think, to me, those are drawn out in your report in really important ways, and it shows you not, I think the other side says, oh, it's, introducing federal Indian law into the state of Maine context creates uncertainty in the law, but there's nothing more uncertain in this self-generating act passed in 1980 that everything has to now be litigated on. At least there's a backbone and background of federal Indian law to draw on, and that's why I point to the Montana exception as a kind of framework. But I think for me it's those levels that this report really helps us think with, and I really appreciate the work you both did to articulate this.
Harold.
Yeah, thank you so much, Donna, for inviting your special guests for today. It's a great pleasure to have heard Evan and Roger both explain not only what they have done, but why they have done what they have done. And I think it's a major contribution. Also, thanks to Darren, who built upon what was just said by Evan. And I'd like to build now on what Darren said, and he made a reference that may not be clear to your audience entirely when Darren was mentioning that it was a brief number of years, about 4 or 5 years, that the tribes were federally recognized like other recognized tribes in the country. And that status between 1975, 1976, and 1980 was altered as a result of the Settlement Act. And Evan earlier referred to the fact that there were two different interpretations, understandings of both sides, and he's right about that. But you could actually multiply that too, because within the native communities, there were different opinions about what that claim was about. And both among the Passamaquoddy and among the Penobscot, about one third refused to accept the Settlement Act. So that's an important thing to keep in mind, that it was not like a unanimous position on the part of the tribes. And on the state side, there were also multiple different actors. And a major one were the land the paper companies. The paper companies, people forget now, played a huge role, because the land claim that involved two-thirds of the state of Maine, that's about 12.5 million acres. Maine in total is about 20 million acres. But 12.5 million acres came under the claim when the Passamaquoddy filed suit. And Judge Edward Jinyu, whose name is often now forgotten, but he made an extraordinary important decision. Because at the time, half of the state's lands were owned by paper and forest product companies. That 75% was by only 9 corporations. So if you just begin to think about the vested interest in terms of the political economy of the state of Maine, and the paper companies and the landholding companies of timber and other operations, was enormous. Maine is a forest state. So not just a rural state, as Darren was referring to it, but as a forest production state, and has been since time immemorial. That's already the case in the 17th century, when there are lots of disputes about cutting trees for masts of the navy buildup in England as well as in France. So early on, there were disputes about the natural economy for purposes of the political economy. And in essence, both Roger and Evan have both referred to, and Darren too, about the moral obligations. And it was the third concept of the moral economy. And those three households, regulations, if you will, that's what economy means, right? Oikos and nomos, the law of the households. How do you run a household? Have these three components, and the components is not just the natural environment and all the species, the trees, the cleanliness of the water, the cleanliness of the air, and how people adjust to that natural environment in a balanced way that sustains populations for multiple generations, still time out of mind. But it's also the political economy, the way people make use and tap into these resources for purposes of production of wealth and well-being. And then, you get the accumulation of wealth in certain hands by people who own the means of production within these political economies. And that's where the power comes in, and that's where the legislation comes in, and that's where the laws are coming in, and that's where the jurisprudence comes in, and the whole top of it that basically should have been regulated by a moral economy. A concept is not well known, but both Roger and Evan implicitly refer to it. Namely, what is that? What are the principles that guide us in terms of right and wrong? What is a fair? What is fair? What is equitable? And those concepts are completely thrown out of the window by now in the type of society that we now live in, with utterly amoral. It's not even immoral. It's an amoral economy that we now live in. But that is nothing new to a degree. It's just a new in terms of the accumulation of the amorality, where people don't even think about anymore about principles of justice and principles of other than power accumulation and wealth accumulation in the hands of very few. And so that element was basic to the state of Maine early on, when you begin to look at the indigenous lands and the dispossession of indigenous lands through so-called treaties. And a good example, and that name has not come up, I think, before, but is a name like William Bingham. Bingham, who had the so-called Penobscot Million. There was a million acres that he invested in, purchased, but it's all dispossessed land for which the title had not yet been cleared. For that, you needed to have the treaties that the close companion of William Bingham, who was a senator from Pennsylvania and a banker, and a British-Dutch conglomerate based in Amsterdam and London were looking for investment in land by taking the land and then accumulating the capital by getting immigrants in it and to make that land worthwhile. And so all in the aftermath of the American Revolution that ended in 1783, a companion of Bingham, namely Henry Knox, the Secretary of War, who was a major landholder in Maine through the so-called Waldo Patent, a massive amount of land taken by his wife's grandfather, Brigadier Waldo, that land was tried to be cleared of title by the treaty with the Penobscot in 1784. The Penobscot refused to sign that. They tried it again in 1786, and they even were contemplating military action, like in the Shays Rebellion in southern Massachusetts. They were contemplating military action against the Penobscot to force them to sign that treaty. But the Penobscot were nowhere to be found in 1784 to sign that treaty. So they finally succeeded in 1796. By that time, a treaty had been made with the Passamaquoddy, but it was like almost like an afterthought, the 1794 treaty. So something happened in that period between the end of the American Revolution and the treaties of 1794 and 1796, which was the Non-Intercourse Act of 1790. And that became the trigger in 1975 when Judge Edward G. New ruled on the Passamaquoddy lawsuit. And that was in January 20th, 1975, Judge Edward G. New concluded a 34-page opinion with these simple words, and I'm quoting, quote, "Judgment will be entered for the plaintiff," which is the Passamaquoddy, "declaring that the Non-Intercourse Act of 1790 is applicable to the Passamaquoddy Indian tribe, and that the act establishes a trust relationship between the United States and the tribe," end quote. Later that same year, in December, Judge Ginyu's judgment was unanimously upheld by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit in Boston. By March 1976, when the deadline for appeal to the Supreme Court passed with neither the state nor the federal government raising its voice, the Circuit Court's declaration became the law of the land. That's an astounding phenomenon, because here you see how laws really happen. It's sometimes through a fluke, someone not contesting, a deadline passes, and suddenly something is etched in, and engraved in law as if it is justice, but sometimes it isn't. So to a great degree, Judge Ginyu, as I understand it, was surprised, as was the Passamaquoddy tribe and its lawyers, that there was no objection being raised by either the state or the federal government. It just slipped into law, but that had an earthquake reverberation in Indian country, in New England, not just in Maine, but for all of New England, for all the tribes that followed in the Passamaquoddy, later joined by the Penobscot lawsuit. By that time, of course, as a result of that, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Department of Interior, and the Department of Justice now were suddenly having to act upon their trust responsibility, although it hadn't been really tested whether or not that 1790 Non-Intercourse Act was indeed applicable or not. It just wasn't tested. That was the whole point of Ginyu hoping that the Supreme Court would make an informed decision. For the tribe, it was lucky to a large degree that it didn't go to the Supreme Court, because who knows how these judges would have ruled. We all know that they are humans, and as Evan earlier referred to, there's an ideological bedrock within which these people have been raised and have formed their opinions about things. And they may judge, as they did in the Penobscot River sovereignty case, they may judge in a surprising way, because not thinking critically, rethinking like the two of you have done, critically rethinking what really happened in this case in 1980 and subsequent. So I'll leave it for by that for now. But it's an important thing to keep in mind that that window that Darren was referring to was an important one, because that has become the baseline that the Penobscot and the Passamaquoddy, and subsequently the Holden Band of Maliseet and the Aroostook Band of Mi'kmaq, are all now referring to, that that is a status commensurate with the status of other Indian tribes in the United States.
So, Evan, go ahead.
Yes. During that period, that is a critical period. And it was during that period that Governor Longley and others, driven by fear, took to, I guess, if there was some such thing as social media back then, there wasn't, but they used the public relations realm to fight. They didn't fight in the courts at that point. They fought it through public relations. And they created this mantra of no nation within a nation. And it hit again and again and again. And that shaped the way they chose to negotiate with the tribes over the settlement. It was a very arduous, as I understand it, very arduous negotiation, spending 2 or 3 years on the land part of it, and then compressed into a very short number of months the part of it that had to do with jurisdiction. What do the tribes control? What does the state control? And that got put into the main implementing act. From the state's perspective, they swallowed hook, line, and sinker the no nation within a nation demagoguery. And that became the North Star for the state from that point on. But I want to read what I think is the critical passage from the report of the United States Senate Select Committee on Indian Affairs on the settlement. Here's what it said. And this was in response, as Harold pointed out, there were a number of members of both tribes, perhaps of all tribes, that were opposed to the settlement. And this passage, this response by the select committee in reporting the proposed settlement to the full U.S. Senate, this is what they said in response to that worry by some tribal members. The settlement, responding to the concern raised by some tribal members that, quote, the settlement amounts to a destruction of the sovereign rights and jurisdiction of the Passamaquoddy tribe and the Penobscot Nation, the Senate committee said, while the settlement represents a compromise in which state authority is extended over Indian territory to the extent provided in the Maine Implementing Act, in keeping with these decisions, the settlement provides that henceforth the tribes will be free from state interference in the exercise of their internal affairs. Thus, rather than destroying the sovereignty of the tribes, by recognizing their power to control their internal affairs, and by withdrawing the power which Maine previously claimed to interfere in such matters, the settlement strengthens the sovereignty of the Maine tribes. In addition, the Maine Implementing Act grants to the Passamaquoddy tribe and Penobscot Nation the state constitutional status of municipalities under Maine law. In view of the home rule power of municipalities in Maine, this also constitutes a significant grant of power to the tribes. End quote. So you cannot read that and say, oh, this municipal status language that's in the Maine Implementing Act subtracts from the authority, the sovereignty of the tribes. You cannot read that to say it subtracts from. You can only read it to say it adds to. And yet, the no nation within a nation mindset is so powerful that just 3 years later, in the first case that came around the Settlement Act, dealing with the high stakes Beano game on the Penobscot Nation, it's called the Stilfen case. And yet, the state Supreme Court really read the agreement as subtracting, as the municipal, when you're acting in a municipal capacity, you know, all bets are off. So you cannot raise funds through Beano to pay for services on the tribe. You can't have a game on the reservation, raising funds exclusively to provide services to the reservation and its citizens. Somehow that's not internal. Anyways, I picking up a couple of things that Harold said, I thought that was important to, for me at least, and I think Roger, this really crystallized a lot of the stuff as we got through all this.
Well, and one of the things that's so striking to me is that this no nation within a nation language completely contradicts the clear language of the Constitution of the United States. Where embedded in the Constitution is the understanding that tribes are nations, and that therefore any treaty with the tribes needs to be ratified by the Senate, the same way a treaty with France, say, would need to be ratified by the Senate. And that was the basis of the Non-Intercourse Act, which was the basis of Jeannot's decisions. And so for the state of Maine, I've said before, you know, many of us are proud in the way, in many of the ways that Maine is exceptional. Its beauty, its natural resources, the genuineness of its people, and so on. And yet where we are truly exceptional in a distressing way is that we treat the tribes and tribal members as second-class citizens. In clear defiance of the Constitution. And when I was writing the senator in the first instance, the McGirt decision had just been decided in Oklahoma, declaring that a significant part of that state was Indian territory. And I read an article in the New York Times that quoted Justice Gorsuch, the only sitting Supreme Court justice with experience in Indian law. And he said, and now he's talking about the Cherokees in Oklahoma, but it very much applies to Maine as well. We have the treaties, okay, which have been in existence and promising this tribe since before the Trail of Tears that they would not be subject to state jurisdiction. And this is the part that's significant to me. He says, precisely because the states were known to be their enemies. And that's the way the state of Massachusetts and the state of Maine have operated since the beginning. And there was this period between 75 and 80 where the relationship was reversed and brought into accord with the US Constitution. Sovereign tribes and the government joined the lawsuit against the state of Maine. And then the state tried to do everything they could to flip that around in the land claim settlement and the interpretation since then. I just want to add one thing to Harold's discussion of it slipping through because it wasn't appealed to the Supreme Court. I was not in Maine when the land claim settlement happened, but I was in Maine when the public lots settlement happened. And the lower court and then the appeals court had ruled that these lands that, in the view of industry, had been essentially given to the large industrial landowners, the courts had ruled that no, these were still state lands. And I was party to discussions where representatives of the landowners decided not to appeal those decisions because the stakes were too high. They'd rather deal with the ambiguity of the uncertainty of how the Supreme Court would rule rather than, in switching back to the land claims, a decision that would say that two-thirds of the state still belonged to the tribes, which was some of the risk. So it was a calculated decision to live with ambiguity, I believe, rather than risk a conclusion that would be adverse to the interests of the state.
So I have a question. Was there in your research, either one of you can answer, or you both can answer, but was there something that surprised you in your research that really stuck with you?
I would say that the clarity with which we found that the two understandings were so divergent. You know, I will say that even through almost all my time on the Indian on the Tribal State Commission, I believed, I had no reason not to believe, with one big exception, that there wasn't a common understanding. Because I remembered in 1980, when I was living in South Portland and learned of the settlement, seemed like a big victory. There must have been a common understanding here, but there wasn't. They were just so divergent, really, from the beginning. And why? Why did that happen? And it was that, Donna, that I think the clarity with which, when you read the record, the clarity with which the tribal understanding diverged from the state, and that the tribal understanding is the correct one legally. And
Roger.
The second thing was, I think Nicole Friedrichs, Professor Friedrichs' report from Suffolk Law School back in 2017, I think, at the request of the commission, tracked the so-called Section 16B provision. This was the provision that, during my time on the Tribal State Commission, this was the provision that tribal members of the commission really were angry about. Very insistent, very consistent in their insistence that they never agreed to this so-called Section 16B. For your listeners, Section 16B is what says that, to the extent that there's a federal law that benefits federally recognized tribes, if such federal law conflicts with the civil or criminal or whatever regulatory scheme of the state, it will not apply in Maine.
And that's what's been used to veto progress for the tribes in Maine by the state ever since.
Yes. And it turns out that, as Professor Friedrichs identified, and as far as we could tell from our research, confirmed, that provision was inserted as a so-called savings or construction clause days before, way after the public hearings were held on the Settlement Act, days before it actually went to full vote, to the full Senate and House for votes. And the tribal negotiators were unaware of it until the last minute, no chance to respond, no chance to bring it back to the tribes for a vote, in violation of an understanding between the state and tribal negotiators that there would be no change in the law without coming back and discussing it and coming to an agreement on those changes.
Roger,
that was apparently inserted by Senate committee staff, likely at the insistence, I'm going to say likely because I'm not sure, but there was a tell in the article by John Patterson in his history in the state, I can't remember the name of the journal, but in 2012, his recollections, he said that they wanted to make sure, the state, that this prohibition would apply to all future laws, federal laws. So I'm guessing that the state talked with the Senate committee staff, got that piece inserted as a construction clause or savings clause, and there you go. So on the one hand, there are two pieces here. One is that the state chooses to ignore federal Indian law in the understanding of internal tribal matters. And two, Section 16B, which is used as a hammer, was inserted without negotiation. So those two things, I think, are the big black marks on this settlement.
So Roger, what about you? Was there something that struck you?
I think Evan has captured it well. The one thing that strikes me that's not directly tied to the research that we did is the endurance of this trope, this idea that the tribes traded their sovereignty for municipal status as part of the land claim settlement. Nothing could be further from the truth. And yet every article I read in the Bangor Daily News, for example, about this issue quotes it as if it's fact. And one of our hopes is that by laying out exactly what happened, we can undermine the bedrock certainty many players seem to operate from about that misunderstanding. I mean, it's inconceivable that having won federal recognition in the 70s, that they would turn around a few years later and say, oh, our sovereignty of tribes doesn't matter. We'll accept municipal status. But that's what's asserted by people who haven't looked into what really happened.
Darren.
Yeah, no, and there's two lines of thought that I think are really important here. In our practice session the other day, Harold talked about the idea that settlements are compromises, and I think that's in some ways you can. If you're not informed, you can kind of make that argument, Roger, against like what just Roger just said. Like you can say like, well, they got some land and they give up, sovereignty. Like you can make that argument. You definitely have to forget about those 5 years. But I think one of the points that Harold made, that settlements are unhappy. Both sides lose. We understand that this is a negotiation. Again, just enhancing this differences of interpretation, even those, and I'm so glad you talked about, there have been stalwart holdouts, people who did not vote in favor of the Settlement Act who were, get to tell the rest. I didn't vote. I was a minor, but that idea like, hey, I told you they were going to screw us, you voted for it. And the idea that drives the people, I think, that voted for it was the compromise that, and in fact, in our communities, we tend to refer to this as the land claims, not the Settlement Act, right? And there's great consternation and debate within our communities that we're like, oh, it's the land claim settlement. And you're like, well, actually, it doesn't say land claims, and it just says Maine Indian claims settlement. There's this whole, framework on its very basis that we saw it as a compromise, like, yeah, we won't take 2/3 of your state and we'll give up that claim in exchange for a much smaller part of the state. That idea, that's where the compromise was sort of being laid, as opposed to like, we're giving up the foundations of us and who we are as nations for 100,000 acres of land. I mean, that trying to understand that logic is so important for people to, to get these multiple interpretations. And so, I have a lot of other stuff to say about, the timing of things like the Stilfen decision, which comes before a really important Supreme Court decision, which leads to the necessity for the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act in effect. But then, that's where that clause, that 16B, actually has been profoundly impactful of our sovereignty because 4 years after the Stilfen case, you have the Supreme Court saying that actually, if a state is doing a regulatory, has something legal for certain groups of people and not others, it's presumed then the tribes have a regulatory authority of it, even in situations with well, in California, where there's a sort of limitation on tribal sovereignty there through the Public Law 290, that there's this idea that we should still be able to do it. If Stilfen had been decided after Cabazon, I wonder, like, if we would have had a different framing in that 16B part, kind of sliding us back in always to impacting our sovereignty. It's read as a thing like federal laws that benefit blah 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 blah. And then, of course, my frustrations that this is like therapy for me. Thank you, everyone, for bearing with me. And then my frustrations that they get to interpret 16B as broadly as possible. Like it's basically the state can just say whatever we think it is, and then internal tribal matters is like very narrow, very quite narrow. But like that these are like frustrating and seemingly racist frameworks of interpretation only to kind of keep us in this position. And I think that's where, anyway, thanks for the therapy session. But I was just saying, like, those are the things that I think about when it comes to this, which are very inside baseball of like, where's federal Indian law and how does the Settlement Act fit into it? But I think it's a really, your report really brings us back to those discussions, and I think in helpful ways.
So, Roger, I want to give you
Session
the
was very
last
helpful.
word.
I just thank you, Donna and Evan, and Evan, it's been great to work with you and all the heavy lifting you did in the research, and then to be able to have the opportunity to be in a conversation with you, Donna, and Harold and Darren to help bring our findings to the larger world of Maine. And it's clear we all hope that people pay attention to the fundamental injustice that's been done and is continuing through ignoring the tribal understanding of what happened, and particularly the 16B that is so troublesome. So thank you very much.
I'll close with this thought. When independent experts, people who have spent their lives working Maine's land and laws, arrive at the same conclusion as Wabanaki nations, it raises an important question. Not whether the tribes are right, but why the state continues to say they are not. Thank you to Harold and Darren and our special guests, Evan Richter and Roger Milliken Jr. And thank you for joining us, and tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.